coming here to service today, the High Holy Day, the last day of unleavened bread. I know for myself, it's just it's went by in a rush, and it seems like we just started, and here we're concluding this holy season. And it seemed like things just couldn't be better weather-wise. It's just beautiful weather. We see life, you know, just springing forth everywhere, the beautiful trees and all the flowering things. And it just, I think, just adds to it, to everything. And, of course, today is a high Sabbath day, and we are commanded to come together, a place of God's choosing, and worship Him on this day. And it just... it's something we can do. It's an action we can take. It is the weekly Sabbath and also the high Sabbath days. But it's good that we can show our faith and show our obedience by gathering here. And I don't know about everyone, but personally, this Sabbath, this Passover, unleavened bread, it's... I don't know, it's been kind of a special one for me. I think I've grown in knowledge and appreciation for what God has done for us. And in a large part to the sermons and messages we've received, it's really helped me. I know Dr. Ricks, Mike Sedlock, Stanley Roberts, and the gentleman from St. Louis, Darwin Jarvis, we all had some really good teaching. I think we went in depth into why we keep it, why we keep the certain days we keep. And I think everything just worked really well. And it's nice to see, although we've got a small, rather small crowd today, I think we're strong, you know, strong in spirit. I think this affirms our, you know, our closeness to God. It shows us His just plan of salvation, and each year we keep it, it just brings us closer to God and reaffirms our faith and all that we do. And this is, like I say, a high holy day of the last day of unleavened bread. So we'll just turn to Levi, 23rd chapter. Leviticus 23. And of course, the 8th verse. You shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. The 7th day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. And that just affirms that this is a high holy day, and we're keeping it as we should. And turn back also to Exodus 12. Verse 17. So you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this day I will have brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. So there we see why they're observing it, and it's an everlasting ordinance. And also just a page over on the Exodus 13. Exodus 13, verse 6. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the 7th day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your sons in that day, saying, this is done because of what I, the Lord, did for you when I came up from Egypt. It shall be a sign to you on your hand as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season, year to year. And I think there is probably where most nominal Christianity would just drop it. It represents bringing Israel out of Egypt, bringing them out of the sin of Egypt. And I think most people say, well, it's for the Jews, it's for ancient Israel. But we do read it's an everlasting ordinance. And as we know, it's not just for ancient Israel. For them, it represented delivering them from Egypt, from bondage and the sin of Egypt. But let's turn to 1 Corinthians and see more what it means for us as well. 1 Corinthians 5. First Corinthians 5 and verse 7. And here we have the Apostle Paul. He's addressing the church at Corinth. This is probably, what, 3 decades after Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. So, therefore, we can see that it does concern us. And Paul is saying, therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. And he knew they were unleavened because they were keeping the feast of unleavened bread. For indeed, Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. Let us keep the feast. Plainly says that we should keep the feast. Not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And I think that's pretty clear that it's what we should do, and that's what we do do. And also, you know, as we went through Passover and unleavened bread, I think this was a special one for me, because maybe all the messages that we had, it just everything come together. But it reminds us year to year of the sacrifice that was made for us, the awesome price that was paid to redeem us. And also the awesome promises made. And let's just turn to John chapter 15. John chapter 15, verse 14. And Christ addressing the apostles, he said, "You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you." And that's just a small point, but it lets us know that our potential is to be part of the God family. It's just an awesome thing that we can't even appreciate. That concludes what I have to say, and I think at this time we were going to take up the offering for today. Did you want to read? Should we read the scripture?
You know, they were talking about rain today, but looks like we have got a fabulous day for the last day of unleavened bread, and for us, a good attendance. So I'm happy for everybody that could make it. And today what we're going to talk about is Cures for hypocrisy. Cures for hypocrisy. Say one day you meet someone, and he's saying, "Oh, I'll never act like so-and-so." And you know that's patently untrue because he does exactly the thing he's criticizing. You know, he's totally full of hot air. He's being a total hypocrite. Then you think for a minute, have I ever done anything like that? And we realize, you know, it's part of human nature. People are just hypocritical. You know, well, I would never do that. And it's easy to become full of hot air. And the days of unleavened bread are about truth, about being leavened, you know, kind of like honest and tight instead of all puffed up with hot air. And you'll see that in 1 Corinthians 5:6-8. Not being puffed up, not being hypocritical, not being self-righteous. So we're going to, this afternoon, examine a few cures to fight hypocrisy and being puffed up with hot air. The first thing is, I think everybody needs to accept the reality that human nature is tricky. You know, as Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is, or the mind, is desperately wicked. Who could even know it? And I've got this book. It's on critical decision making, you know, for big decisions in the world. And the guy lists all kind of biases that allow people to make terrible decisions. And what amazed me, well, there's so many biases. Human nature is just full of it. I can even rattle them all off. So with human nature being what it is, what we want to do is, there are people, for instance, you'll hear in the press, some politicians are saying, we need to quiet down the rhetoric. We need calm, kind rhetoric in our political discussions. The very same people who are demonizing various industries and various people and are probably still doing it. Hypocrisy. By the way, that's a common hypocrisy. We do it, it's okay, but when they do it, it's terrible. And you're going to see that all the time. If that shocks anybody, it shouldn't be. Human nature is very tricky. Or the guy says, oh, I hate people that gossip. And he goes, yakety-yak, yak-yak, yakety-yak, yak-yak. You know what I mean? He's doing exactly what he just said he hates. Well, all that's very normal. Let's go to Matthew 16. We're going to look at some ways that we as individuals can fight that and become truly more unleavened and kind. Matthew 16. We're going to look at the opposite of being unleavened. That's the Pharisees. Matthew 16:5-6. And when his disciples were come to the other side, you know, of the lake, they had forgotten to take bread. Verse 6, Matthew 16. Then Jesus said unto them, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Verse 11. How is it that you do not understand that I spake it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? It's their doctrines and their practices he was talking about. The Pharisees are almost a definition of hypocrisy and self-righteousness. They were jealous of Christ's success. When he healed Lazarus, they almost went apoplectic. When he brought Lazarus back from the dead, I mean. And his message is completely baffling. When they tried to ask him trick questions and set him up, he turned the tables on them. They were so jealous of Christ's success and his popularity, it just drove them even more self-righteous and more crazy. So much so, in spite of their piety as holy men, they actually plotted his murder. Didn't matter what the evidence was. And they actually plotted Lazarus' murder too, because his coming back from the grave after 4 days was just too much of a witness against them. They were very hateful. And we all have to guard against self-righteousness. Believe it. We can be self-righteous too. The second cure for self-righteousness is develop a servant's attitude. You know, they call it servant leadership. That's why the Messiah had all of us do the foot washing a week or so ago, or 8 days ago, because foot washing is what a servant does, and we all need to be servants. Let's go to Luke 22. Luke, the 22nd chapter, verse 24. Luke 22, 24. And there was also strife among them, meaning the 12 apostles, which of them should be accounted the greatest. It's a great little thing for them to be arguing about. Verse 25, and he said to them, the kings and Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. In other words, the guy who has the high position, boy, he benefits from everybody serving him. And in the Roman Empire, they could see really great examples of that as well, of course. But you shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. In other words, the man with the least seniority or least rank. And he that is chief, as he that does serve. For which is greater, he that sits at meat or he that serves? Is not he that sits at meat, but I, you know, meaning Christ, am among you as one that serves. And that's the kind of leadership that the world is going to get in the kingdom of God. That's the kind of leadership that God wants. In other words, the leader puts more time and effort into it than anybody else. The leader puts in more time and effort than anybody else. One of the things that can puff us up is flattery or praise. And I'm just going to make the statement. When someone flatters you or praises you, of course, you say thank you, which is the polite thing to say. But then I would say, handle that praise or flattery like you're handling a jar of nitroglycerin. Very gently. You know, you put it away very gently because you mess with it too much. Well, if you think about flattery and praise too much, it'll puff you up. And you get the big head. And often, as you know, as the Bible says, pride comes before a fall. Oh, you're so wonderful. And you know, whatever you did that was well. You know, like nitroglycerin, praise and flattery can blow up on you in a second and puff you up. When God, anything that we do have, it's because of God. If you have a knowledge that most of the world doesn't have, it's because God has gifted you with that knowledge. If you have talents that other people don't have, because God gifted you with that talent, the credit should go to God. If that makes sense. It goes to God, not us. Let's go back to Matthew 20. Matthew 20:20. An easy verse to remember. But we're still in the flattery kind of thing. Matthew 20:20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee, you know, the sons of thunder, as you probably hear those two young men known as, children with her sons, worshiping him, meaning Christ, and desiring a certain thing of him. And so the mother came, and she probably was sincere, because mothers would believe this. She wasn't lying. She said, my sons are the two most loyal and best servants you've gotten, whatever elaboration she put on it, which I'm sure those two heard it, and you know, my mom said it, she's right. You know, we should be the top two guys in the kingdom among the 12. Verse 21, he said unto her, what will you? She said to him, grant that my two sons may sit, the one on your right hand, the other on your left in the kingdom, meaning the top two positions. It wasn't just room arrangements he was interested in. But Jesus answered and said, you know not what you ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? And they said unto him, notice the two said, we are able. And he said unto them, you shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. In other words, actually, they did do great things like Christ in future years. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom is prepared of my Father. So we don't need to be competing with each other for higher positions of the kingdom of God. I mean, do the best you can. God expects certain things, and only God knows how much talent and abilities he's given you. But we don't have to outrighteous each other. That's how you get into self-righteousness. You try to outrighteous and outposition other people, and you get unnecessary competition. Oh, I'm better than so-and-so, and you know, And I'm not saying you aren't better than me or other people in certain areas and ways, but that's not the kind of thing we should be thinking about. Just try to give whatever talent you have, give the credit to God. Don't take it yourself, and don't try to outrageous everybody else or some other similar kind of thing. You know what I'm trying to say. The talents, the credit belongs to God. Verse 27, Jesus called unto him, and he said to him, you know that the princes and Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them, but it shall not be so among you. But whosoever shall be great among you, let him be your minister. The word minister means servant. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister or serve, and to give his life for many. That's the way we should approach things. And leadership in this church should be based on what's called servant leadership. It's a much better way to lead than what the world does. Matthew 25, verse 37. And then shall the righteous answer and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and fed you, or thirsty and gave you drinks? When saw we thee a stranger, and when saw we thee a stranger, we took in, or naked, and clothed thee? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and came unto you? And the king answered and said unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto, and I want to emphasize the word, least of them. Christ says, if you want to serve God and Christ, do it unto the least of them, my brethren. You've done it unto me. In other words, you take the most powerful guy in the church, or the most popular, or the one that has the most money, and you know, I'll do a lot of stuff for you. That's what the world does, by the way. It's like in a worldly situation, if a guy is one of the top bankers in town, people invite him to all kinds of things because, you know, if they ever need a business loan, cash flow loan, you know, he's the guy. In other words, I scratch your back, you scratch my back. That's not really giving or serving. That's being planned good politics. Not that it's, if you're in business, it's wrong to play good politics or to know the lead banker in town. But the point is, if you want to serve Christ, help the least people in the church. Don't be offended by them, but help the least people. That's a servant's attitude. Serve those who can't serve you back. Remember the example of the Good Samaritan. And so how did the Pharisees handle praise and that sort of thing? Before I answer that, I want to give you one of my little corny stories. Just listen to this corny story. It's called Change. ever since we got married, my wife has tried to change me, this man says. She got me to stop drinking. She even got me to stop smoking. She even got me to stop running around until all hours of the night. She taught me how to dress like a prince. She taught me how to enjoy the fine arts, how to appreciate gourmet food and drink my tea like a proper gentleman should do. She taught me how to appreciate classical music, would you believe it? And even how to invest in the stock market. And the man says to that guy, it sounds like you may be bitter because she changed you so drastically. And that's why you're all having trouble. He says, I'm not bitter. No, now that I'm so improved, my wife just isn't good enough for me anymore. He's just not good enough for him anymore. He's approved him. Well, I believe that's how the Pharisees thought about the Jewish people that they were leaders of. They weren't good enough for them. They were the elites. And they looked down their noses at the little people. And I mean that the way they would have viewed it, the little people. Let's go to Matthew 23. Matthew 23, verse 2 and 3. Matthew 23, 2, saying the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. In other words, they really did have authority. He wasn't saying they didn't have authority. They were the leaders of the Jewish world in Judea. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do, but do not you after their works, for they say and do not. In other words, what he's saying is, yes, they're in the leadership position, and Christ was not asking for a violent revolution, but he said, don't follow their spiritual example. For they bind heavy burdens, verse 4, grievous to be borne. You know, heavy stuff put on people's shoulder. lay them on the men's shoulders, the rules that they make. But they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. We actually have politicians who are making laws about our health stuff that they're immune to. Actually, they have a number of laws, and the congressmen are exempted from their own laws. That's actually a fact, which might surprise a lot of people. But these men were elite, and they exempted themselves from a lot of stuff. It was obviously not a serving attitude. It was elitist, puffed up, unleavened, self-righteous, I'm higher than you attitude. Verse 5, but all their works they do for to be seen of men. So in other words, what is their biggest motivation? Public adoration. Remember I asked, how did the Pharisees handle praise and flattery? They designed a system that would feed it to them. It would feed them praise and adoration. That's what they wanted. All their works they do to be seen of men. Everything they do is for public consumption. There are probably a lot of leaders in the world that way. They might call it in the modern world photo opportunities. You know what I mean? Get in front of the camera, then I'll show off whatever it is I'm showing off. to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. What we think that means is they had these garments they wrapped around. They had wide borders in which they could put things that would give them prestige. I'm not exactly sure how it worked, but maybe in those wide phylacteries, there were little badges. I am a Pharisee of the first degree. I'm a Pharisee who finished Gamaliel's Academy. I'm a Pharisee who went through the whatever workshop. In other words, and as they walked around with these broad phylacteries, and I'm not saying the military is all bad, so I don't mean it quite in that context, but it's like if you see an admiral, and those Navy uniforms are really beautiful. They have all that scrambled egg on the little beak-type helmet, and the admiral has scrambled eggs going this way and that way, and generally they have sleeves here and stuff on their shoulders. You know, when the admiral walks down the ship, everybody maybe gets caught up in this a little bit in your military, you really know he's the Mr. Big because it's all over his uniform. You know, everybody salutes, you know. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I understand there's some tradition behind all that. But in a religious leadership, can you see the vanity in that? Here are all of our badges of rank and position. I'm top rabbi, master, Pharisee, whatever other little thing. Wow, people really got to notice you. And they love the uppermost rooms at the feast and the chief seats in the synagogue. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but I guess at the big festival meetings near and the little auditoriums around the various porches in the temple where 1,000 people met, there probably were special seats up high where the Pharisees sit. And if you got, they had some when I was a Baptist. It was not as much, but there were several seats up in the side, but up front in the podium, up high, and visiting bigwigs like the bishop or whatever would sit there. And you knew he was one of the bigwigs who got to get to the chicken first. But in the old days, that's how it actually worked. And the chief seats. So they got all those chief seats. And greetings in the marketplace. And to be called the men, rabbi, rabbi. Oh, master teacher, master teacher. They probably little bow. And as they walk by and everybody called them that, I'm sure they swelled up with. I'm just try to imagine yourself in that. And then there's that place in Luke where the Pharisees are praying. They said, God, I thank you I'm not as other men are. They probably really meant that. I'm better than other men. Look at, and actually, Christ said they were actually the worst people He put them on the bottom over the people who knew what their human nature really was like. But they invited praise and special honors and on their robes, all kinds of things. Verse 8, Christ says, "But be you not called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all of you are brethren. And call no man your father." He means in the religious hierarchical sense. Yeah, you understand what I mean. Someone could be your mentor father in a particular business, or your real father or grandfather, but you know, I think we all know what he means as a high religious title. Call no man your father upon earth, for one is your father which is in heaven. Neither be you called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you, verse 11, shall be your servant. Christ is saying, serve, serve, serve. And that keeps you humble, 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 or at least hopefully more so. Verse 13, and Christ is getting a little mad at the Pharisees. "But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither you suffer them that are entering to go in." In other words, not only were they not helping people grow spiritually, they were blocking people from growing spiritually. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses." It doesn't mean they were eating concrete and brick. It just meant they were cheating widows out of their inheritance so that to enrich them and their group. "You devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation." We were once having a leadership meeting, and one of our top leaders says, "You ever notice that the guy in your church always makes really, really, really long prayers? You better watch that guy. It's going to be trouble." Now, I realize you can't always generalize. I realize you can't. But the whole point of that is the guy is showing off. He's not trying to show sincere thanks to God for the group. He's showing off. Like, "Oh, I'm the real pious one. This prayer is going to be the longest and the best." And everybody's thinking, hurry up and finish so we can eat. But he's going on and on because he's showing off. Well, that's what the Pharisees did. "For pretense," meaning pretending they're pious, "it is. They make long prayers. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation. One, you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land and make one proselyte. And when he's made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than you yourselves." In other words, when they finally could convert somebody, he was so messed up, he was even worse than they were. I think we can get the general idea. "You fools and blind." Verse 7, "What is greater, the gold or the temple that is sanctified in the gold? Whatsoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever," this is one of their rules, "swear by the gift that is upon it, he is guilty." He says, verse 19, "You fools and blind. For whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift?" And he goes on to tell them they're blind leading the blind. And just keep that in mind. We don't want to act like the Pharisees. Point number 3. Now, this point is hard for me to express in one short sentence, so I'm going to drag it out a little bit, but hopefully it'll be clear. Point number 3, approach other people in the world not as a show-off of our knowledge or of a debater to kind of beat them down over the head for their ignorance, but approach them in love and serve them as much as you can. You want to love them and serve them or set such a good example that someday they're going to ask, "Wow, why are you different? And how are you different?" And that's a great opening. And then you can tell them about your conversion. You might call it the gentle persuasion. And we remember we discussed last time that a person can't walk into this church and probably not get offended right off the street. Probably. Maybe relatives are the exception because they kind of know a little bit about us. But generally speaking, they can't. They have the time to get ready. One of the big things they have to decide is this world around us, is this God's society or not? It took me about 3 or 4 years of internal debate within myself, and I bounced around. But finally, I came to the conclusion that, but it took me 3-4 years, that this society is not God's society. God could do much better. If these were God's churches, God's governments, and all the God's philosophies and God's United Nations, you could elaborate further, God's higher education, whatever, God could do a whole lot better. I finally concluded that the vast majority of this world was deceived. It takes a while for a person to come to that, because they know switching from Sunday to Saturday is a big jump, and they're kind of like, oh, is this a cult? So it's tough for them to make that decision. Plus, remember, nobody ever wins an argument. So what you have to do is you have to show respect for them and respect for their ability to be a free thinker. You can't beat them over the head with the truth. And you have to remember, people have blind spots. Like, for instance, you can read a lot of commentaries from great biblical scholars, and you can gain a lot of background information about the Pharisees and the history, and many verses they understand, really, they do a good job on them. But then, all of a sudden, they run into their blind spot, the Trinity, or heaven and hell, or Sunday, or Easter, or and there are the blind spots. And you just have to say, I just read past that material. And even if you could meet them in person, it wouldn't make any difference. I know enough about human nature to know, from all those biases we study, that when a person has a blind spot, it takes a lot for them to get around it. And even the Apostle Paul, though we know because of the way it was expressed when Christ called him on the road to Damascus, God had been planting doubt in his mind for years. But God had to strike him down and make him blind for 3 days to get him to make the switch. It wasn't easy. So the point I'm getting is be patient with other people. People are not going to believe any of the arguments we give them until they first believe that we like them, until they first believe that we respect them. And maybe in some cases they first believe that we love them. Maybe you can't love everybody, but at least you're a good neighbor, you're friendly, you like them. And then you can introduce them to the truth little by little by little. You can't overwhelm them with too much at once because it's rare they can handle it, little by little. And then give them some time to think about it and for God to work on them. Maybe you can get them thinking about one or two doctrines. A couple months later, maybe give them a booklet. Say, watch a TV show or whatever, you know, other things, tapes. Like in 1 Peter 3, 1 and 2, Peter tells women, he says, wives, win over your unconverted mates with your love and your good example. In a sense, he's really saying you can't really win them over with arguing the word because they don't know the word and they probably wouldn't get it. He's saying win them over with your good example and your love. And that's a good principle for us. And one of the things we need to do first is try to live so that people are going to say, you're different. I've noticed you. You seem to be growing in character. And they ask you, why? Man, what an opening. You can tell a little bit of your conversion story. Maybe just mention one doctrine that flipped in your mind. And then walk away. Don't push too much. Give them time to think about it. It may take several years before they're ready to come to this congregation or whatever God's going to do. Obviously, eventually, God has to call them. We all know that. And they have to accept. Many times, God might use you to call them, but they won't accept. And, you know, you have to accept that. And I think it's hard to be puffed up and looking down on other people if we take a loving, gentle persuasion approach to the people in the world who don't know what they don't know because, as the book of Revelation says, the devil has deceived the whole world. And he has. And he does a good job of it. Let me give the devil his due. He's good at deceiving people. He's got one group deceived one way, another group deceived another way, and he's got them all. And remember, no one wins an argument. You just drive them further to defend their bad position. And remember in Matthew 5, 13 and 14, Christ says, be a light to the world, be salt to the world, be a good neighbor, someone that's good for them. Let's go to Matthew 10, 16. Matthew 10, 16. And in Matthew 10, 16, behold, and he's sending out disciples and to preach the word to the world. Christ says, verse 16, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore wise as serpents." And some translations say smart, clever, depends. But you get wise, clever, smart, and harmless as doves. You don't want to do anything bad to them. But doesn't smart or wise imply, or shrewd, as some translations put it, doesn't that imply that we have to know how to answer an issue? You have to know your Bible well enough on how to answer. And by the way, the key principle in what they call argumentation, and lawyers are taught this in those rhetoric classes, is to know the audience. Know the audience. Find out where that audience is and approach them from where they are. Not from where you are, because you have knowledge they don't have. Where they are. And let me show you where that's a biblical principle. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians 9. And it's not easy. We all probably know the hard way from arguing with relatives and friends. It's not easy to know what the other person is thinking and know how to get through their biases and their blind spots. Because that, maybe that's the best way to put it. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. And this is the Apostle Paul speaking, writing. He says, "For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all." Notice servant. "That I might gain the more." In other words, I'm going to approach people to convert more people. Verse 20. "And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. Them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law." In other words, what he's saying is, he talks to a Jewish person who's really big on all the law, probably even sacrifices and all that stuff. Paul approaches them where they are, from the really heavy Jewish and all the law, including sacrificial law, whatever. He approaches them where they are and probably knows the Bible. Actually, from Paul's case, I know this, the book of Hebrews. He knows it so well, he can actually show them, if they open up a little bit, how the sacrifices were like. The temple was a theater, and everything done on there was really a play leading up to Jesus Christ. And all of those things, including the Passover lamb of the, you know, Exodus 12, all those things really pointed to Christ. I mean, if they understood it. verse 21, "To them that are without law, as without law, being without law to God, but under the law of Christ." He's just saying he wasn't really an unlawful person, but he approached people who don't know the law and think that way from their point of view. "That I might gain them that are without the law." So he went to a, you know, you might call him a hell-raising, sinner, biker-type Gentile. He approached them from their perspective and found a way to identify with them and bring them a little closer to the truth. "To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. And I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you." In other words, didn't matter. If a person was weak and they had all kinds of addictions and they were one big mess, he could approach them saying, "I understand your weaknesses. It's tough to overcome heroin or whatever their problems are, the gambling addiction." He could identify with them. And like a good lawyer, in the sense in which I mean good, I mean effective, you talk to the audience at their level. You don't talk to them at your level. And then you persuade them where they are. And that requires smart. And really, I think it's like a big ship. You might know this. When big, giant ships like aircraft carriers or those big battleships or the big cruise ships come into a port, they actually have to have tugboats bring them in to the line up to the dock. I mean, they actually have to have tugboats do it. Because those ships cannot turn around in a short space. If you try to turn a big ship, it takes a lot of water, space, and somewhat time to turn a big ship around. Well, think of the human mind like a big ship. They're going in a deceived, devilish, at least doctrinally speaking, direction. And you want to turn them around. You cannot do that quickly, sharply. It takes time and water. And water is time. This gets space. If you could just turn them a little and get them going in the right direction, then come back later like a tugboat and tug them again, and then come back later and tug them again, and maybe in a year or two, you've turned them around to see the truth. But it won't be easy. And if you argue with them in a in an emotional, vehement way, it'll backfire. They'll actually reinforce the false stuff. They've proven that in many empirical studies. Human nature is just that way. It takes time. Remember, the cures for hypocrisy and being puffed up are one. Know that human nature, which applies to all of us, it's easy to get puffed up when people flatter you and whatever. Number two, be a servant. Don't let praise puff you up, but keep a serving attitude. I want to get down there and spend time helping other people. You might, if it's appropriate and you can do it, I know everybody can't, so I'm not pushing it. But if you can do some charitable things in the community or serve the church or serve whoever you can serve, that's probably a good thing to do. Number three, love and serve people, or at least make them like you and set such a good example that someday they're going to ask you, why are you different? Why are you more patient or more whatever good characteristic than you used to be? Wow, what an opening to give them a little bit of truth. And then we give them the truth, give it slowly, gently, only a little bit of the time, and not too much. And if we can have those three things, I think we can fight being puffed up and hypocritical.